This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Learns Torah, it's necessary to go to the game reserve for several trips. Because one learns an awful lot about how to learn from the game reserve. You'll notice that the richness of yours, anybody who hasn't been to the game reserve? Nobody hasn't been to the game reserve. Sorry?
I haven't.
You haven't been to the game reserve. That's terrible. Anybody else? What you notice in the game reserve is that the richness of your experience depends on your ability to spot animals. There are always animals around. Except sometimes you see them and sometimes you don't. And it's not just luck. What can be luck is that whether you saw a kill or something like that, that's a matter of luck. But to see virtually every moment of the day the most beautiful animals, that's got nothing to do with luck. That's just got to do with the degree of your perceptiveness. It might be birds, it might be little animals, it might be the kind of things that most people just pass by without really noticing. And the ability to spot animals depends on your ability to notice something out of the ordinary. That's really what it is. Just to notice that something's happening which isn't quite normal. There's some movement, there's some color there that doesn't quite fit in. It's the ability to put your finger on something which is a little bit out of the ordinary. And resulting from that, one is able to experience a great deal of richness. In learning, you've got the same concept, that the degree of richness that you'll experience when you read the Chumash is dictated by the degree of perceptiveness you have in the ability to put your finger on something which seems a little bit out of the ordinary. And that ability is developed through experience and through a critical look, not taking anything for granted, not thinking just because you've been reading the Chumash since you're 5 years old that you know it all. Each time you read it, reading it afresh as if you've never seen it before, and looking at it absolutely critically, that's what will give you the opportunity of noticing something out of the ordinary. And once you're noticing something out of the ordinary, you have the possibility, which may or may not be achieved, of finding the answer. Sometimes you drive in the game reserve and you notice there's something out of the ordinary but you can't see. And you sit and you wait and you wait and you're not sure what it was, and you wait for hours sometimes and you still see nothing. That can also happen. But at least then you have a chance. If you notice something out of the ordinary, you have the chance of seeing that something special. So in the Chumash, if you notice the things that don't quite seem right, then you have a chance of penetrating the inner meaning of the Chumash. And that's the first purpose of the Shir, to teach you how to look at the text of Chumash critically. The second purpose of the shiur is also connected with richness of experience. But here we'll move away from the game reserve into the dining room, in the sense that you'll notice that you can have a little child and you can take a blender and you can stick a bit of meat and vegetables and fruit and all sorts of things in the blender and mush it all up and give it to the child, and that's a very easy form for the child to digest, and the child eats very quickly that way and gets all the nourishment that the child needs. That's one way of eating. But if our food would get mushed up in the blender and served up to us, we wouldn't like it. What's wrong? It's just as nourishing. Imagine that our women folk took our whole dinner and shoved it all into a massive blender and turned it on for a few moments and just gave us one heap of mush. So it would be quicker, would be easier, would be more digested more easily. It's pure richness of experience. Now, people who pretend that these things aren't important to them just don't understand what it is to have richness of experience. No, we like to taste the meat separately and the vegetables separately and the different kinds of food separately and the different kinds of spices. We don't like having everything mushed up into one big mush. Although from a nutritional point of view it's the same, from the point of view of richness of experience, it's necessary to do it the hard way. It's harder to eat a meal that way, it takes longer to prepare, but it's better. And so it is in a sense when one looks at things like the Reader's Digest. The Reader's Digest is very convenient because in a couple of pages of journalistically written literature, one's able to get a taste of a whole lot of books all mushed together. But it's okay, the same as eating a mushtaq meal is alright for somebody who doesn't have teeth, so reading the Reader's Digest is somebody for, is alright for somebody who doesn't have an intellect. I hope there's nobody here who reads the Reader's Digest. Similarly, one finds that when it comes to Chumash, the easy way is to read the digests. There are the equivalents of the Reader's Digests on Chumash. In English, one of the early ones that was written was the Hertz Chumash, which some of you have in front of you, which at that time was a very big step forward in English literature as far as Jewish English literature on the Chumash was concerned. Today they're more sophisticated, such digests. You've got the Art Scrolls, that is an excellent piece of work, but it's still the Reader's Digest. And it's okay for people who don't have teeth, for people who are getting old, and for people who are tired, and for people who are very young and can't quite manage the original. But the purpose of this year, the second purpose of this year, is to introduce you first hand to the classical Mefarshim themselves, so that you should have first hand experience of the way these Mefarshim tackle the text and how they explain it. Some of you are probably able to read the Hebrew quite fluently, some of you might struggle a little bit more, but it doesn't matter. Firstly, as we go on, you'll pick up more and more the ability to read, and secondly, even if you don't pick up the Hebrew, if you just follow carefully the English, at least you're getting a word for word translation of exactly what it says there, not somebody's interpretation of what it says, but the actual thing, and we leave it to you to do the interpreting. When a rabbi gives a sermon or various forms of shiurim, really he's also digesting the food a little bit for you. He's interpreting and he's giving it to you in an interpreted version. But in this shiur, we're giving you the texts as they are. It's for you to interpret. I think we should open the windows a little bit, although it's due the fifth day and a little bit of the sixth day. I want to move forward so that next shiur we can start the creation of man. So I want to cover quite a lot of ground this evening, even at the expense of leaving out a bit of detail. We're only going to concentrate on a couple of individual points, so as to get to the point of the creation of man. Verse 20, chapter 1, verse 20. Vayomer Elohim, and God said, Yishrutzu hamayim sheret nefesh chaya. Let the water swarm forth swarms of living souls. Soul, not in the metaphysical sense, but nefesh means, as distinct from neshama, nefesh is the life force, something living. Ve'ofyo feif al ha'aretz, and birds shall fly over the land, al pnei rakia ha'shamayim, on the face of the skies of the heaven. Ve'yivra Elokim et ha'taninim ha'gdolim, and God created the great fish. Et kol nefesh ha'chaya ha'romeset asher shatzu ha'mayim leminehem, all the living souls that swarm and spread over the water, each one according to its type, ve'et kol of kanat leminehem, and every winged bird according to its type, v'yar Elokim ki tov, that God saw that it was good, v'yavarech otam Elokim le'mor, and God blessed them saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the sea in the seas, and let the birds multiply in the land. And it was evening and it was morning and it was the fifth day. I want to go a little bit further before we stop. And God said, let the land bring forth living souls according to its kind, behema, cattle, veremes, and creeping animals, v'chayto eretz limina, and wild animals, each one according to its kind, v'yehi chen, and it was so. V'yat Elokim et chayat ha'aretz limina, and God made the wild animals of the earth, each one according to its kind, v'et ha'behema limina, and the cattle according to its kind, v'et kol remes ha'adama limineyu, and all the insects of the land according to their kind, vayar Elokim ki tov, and God saw that it was good. Up till there we're going to take it. Now there are countless questions one can ask on this little piece of Chumash, and as I said, we're only going to deal with one or two. The first thing that I want to just point out before we get stuck into it is further evidence of the evolutionary process. You remember we showed right at the beginning that according to everybody, the world was created by evolution. There's absolutely no question about that, that the world was created by evolution. Not quite as Darwin figured it out, but not that far off. Certainly up till the point of the creation of man, the world was an evolutionary development. And we're going to show tonight, and particularly next week, that even the creation of man was an evolutionary development. On verse 24, Vayomer Elokim Totzei Haaretz Nefesh Chaya Lemina, the creation of the animals, it says, and God said, let the land bring forth living souls, each one according to its kind. Says Rashi, those of you who have Rashi before you, Totzei Haaretz, Rashi comments on the word Totzei Haaretz, let the land bring forth. What's the land got to do with it? Says Rashi, Hu Shepirashti, this is what I've already explained, Shehakol Nivra Miyom Rishon, that everything was created on the first day, and all that was necessary subsequently was to bring them to fruition. But it was all created on the first day. The only act of creation was the act of creation of the first day. Everything subsequent was evolutionary. And Rashi brings this as an indication that when animals are going to be created, that's a major step forward in the process of creation. That's a major creation all on its own. We're told, Totzei Haaretz, let the land bring forth the wild animals. It's not something which God created himself, so to say. Similarly, on the previous part, where we talked about the birds and the fish, it's Yishrutzu Hamayim, let the water bring forth. And so on, we see that inherently in the land and in the water, there was already the potential to develop the animal world from that. Okay, so we're still on the evolutionary line. Creation took place on the first day only, and we learned that there was one substance which was created on the first day, whatever that was, a very basic atomic structure that was created on the first day, and everything else was evolved from that basic atomic structure right to the land and the water, which had within them the ability to produce living souls, the ability to produce live, real, living animals. The interesting thing to see, of course, is going to be the step to man. Is man also going to be produced by the land? How is man exactly produced, and how does this work? But up till now, everything has been 100% evolutionary. Furthermore, before we leave this point, the Medrash says on this verse, "Vayomer Elokim Totzei Haaretz Nefesh Chaya Leminan." God said, "Let the land bring forth living soul." And I told you that soul is not the metaphysical sense of the soul; it's not neshama. Soul, in this sense, means the living force, that which distinguishes a living animal from vegetable, right? That the drive for life. Says the Medrash, Hu nefesh Adam harishon, that is the soul of Adam, of the first man that was created here. When God came forward and he said, let the animal be created, which is what God is saying here, says the Medrash, that wasn't only the animal, that was the life force of Adam as well. What happens in the next psukim is something else, that's a further development. But the life force, that which drives us to live, we're not talking about intellect, we're not talking about spirit, we're not talking about any human aspect of ourselves, but merely our physical bodies, that was not created in the next verse. If you look a little bit further, verse 26, God says, Vayomer Elokim, and God says, Naase Adam b'tzalmeinu kidmuteinu, let us make man in our own image. That's converting man into a godly image. That's giving him intellect and the ability to express his thoughts and spirit and soul and so forth. That's a much further development in the evolutionary, and at this point I put evolutionary in inverted commas, state of human development. But the human body was created according to the Medrash in verse 24, right together with the apes. Darwin is right, absolutely right, there's no question about it. The human body evolved, and its evolutionary process was brought about in exactly the same way as the rest of the animals. We don't know if Darwin is correct in how many years it took. We certainly know that he's not correct in the fact that it's just merely coincidental and survival of the fittest and all that kind of thing. This was godly directed and was ordained from the very beginning. When God created that first little atom on the first day, he knew exactly how it was going to evolve. And it was no mistake that man came out of this. Not even just the human body, not even up to this point. Everything has been carefully worked out, and everything has its place, and everything has its purpose. But Darwin is correct in stating that the body of man was an evolutionary process. Darwin gets stuck on the next point. Then he has a missing link. Okay, we'll find the missing link. It's not a problem to find the missing link. It's based on a simple misunderstanding. But up to this point, it's purely evolutionary. So at this point, we already have what might have been sort of ancient caveman, right? Not caveman with an intellect, but really, really the man in his baboon form. Here it is.
Isn't the brain a very, very special thing for a human being? I mean, our brains are very different, so I understand.
From an ape? The physical brain. Don't forget, in the same way as our bodies are no longer the same as our brain, as an ape either, right? The evolutionary process physically has continued. So the evolutionary process of the human body, including his mind, must have continued to adapt for its purpose. And its purpose was to be able to accept a human intellect, right? So whether that process took place still at this point or in the next stage, that further evolution, we don't know. Right, but even the human brain alone is not what distinguishes him from the ape, or shall we say the mere physical structure of the human brain. Right, there's another element which is thrown in, which is obviously the spiritual element, which affects the brain and to a large extent is contained by the brain. But that's the point which really is different. The exact process of evolution, obviously we can't figure out from the Chumash. It's not our business to do that. That's the scientist's business, to work out exactly how it went from A to B to C and what stages were passed in the process. That's for the scientists to work out. The Torah tells us only that which we need to know in order to live a better life. That's all that the Torah tells us. The Torah is not here to give us scientific facts. Okay. That's that point. I'm mentioning this just by way of introduction to next week's shiur, which is going to be a very exciting step forward in understanding what a human being is all about in relationship to the animal kingdom. It's very strange how people react when Darwin came out with his theory, because the essence of it was so false, because the real purpose of it was so false. I mean, the real essence of Darwin's theory is that it was chaotic, that it just so happened, that there is no God. And the reaction of religious society against that was, you're talking rubbish, and everything you say is rubbish. But when you sit and you look at it carefully and you see with an open mind what the Chumash is really saying, you see that you've got to pick and choose. Some of it is rubbish, and some of it is wrong, and some of it might be right and might be wrong, we don't know, and some of it is definitely right. And in dealing with secular knowledge, with chokhmah, one has to develop the ability to sift, to know that which is correct and can therefore be adopted, and that which is incorrect and must therefore be rejected. We don't reject all secular knowledge and say, you know, secular is nothing and secular is wrong. Not at all. Chokhmah bagoyim tamin. If you're told that the non-Jewish world has developed great, great wisdom, you're entitled to believe that and accept that. However, we have to be selective in our understanding of non-Jewish wisdom, because some of it is right and some of it is not correct. When it comes to Torah, we don't have to worry. We don't have to be selective. All we have to be selective in Torah is who we learn from, but to make sure that one's interpretations are correct. But in the terms of the material of Torah, whatever the Torah tells us, that is true, that is acceptable. We simply have to understand it. I want to stop on two points, really. The first point is the following. From what were the fish created? It says so in the Chumash. From the water. Right? And the birds? Also from the water. Look now, chapter 2, verse 19. You're laughing. What did you discover there?
Out of the ground.
Yep, the birds are here created out of the ground. Does everybody see that?
Mm-hmm.
So we have a problem. Okay? That's when you're driving through the game reserve and you see the grass moving. Something's going on. There's something here that you've got to investigate. This isn't simple. And the next thing I want to stand on is the following. What brocha was given to the fish? God blesses the fish. What's the blessing that he gives to the fish? Be fruitful and multiply. Right. What blessing does he give to the birds? Sorry? the same? Is it the same as the fish and the bears get the same bracha? Sorry? Right, favoritism. The fish will be fruitful and multiply, and the birds only multiply. What bracha do the animals get? The cattle and the wild animals. Sorry? That's an instruction, that's not a blessing. Some people think that's a curse. Show me where it says that. What verse? No, that's to man he's talking there. That's the same blessing as he gives you. That's good to point that out. What blessing was that? Similar to which one? To the fish, right? And what blessing does he give to the wild animals? Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing at all. So he gives one to the birds, two to the fish, two to man, and the fish and the man brought is the same, and nothing to the wild animals. That needs investigation. That's important. There's a third thing I want to look at. Sorry, Dave. Can you pass me? Where's Baalotecha? And Vayikra and Bamidbar? This is in Baalotecha. After the Jews are given the mon, you can imagine what a miracle this was, what a wonderful thing this was, the mon. Then we're told, Va'asaf suf asher bekirbo, the masses of Jews that were among them, hit'avu ta'ava, all of a sudden they had a craving. And they started crying. And they said, Mi achileinu basa. Who will give us meat? If only we had meat. And we got mon. Who wants mon? We want meat. Zacharnu et hadaga asher nachal b'mitzrayim chinam. We remember the fish we used to get in Mitzrayim. Aye, was that fish? Can you imagine what fish that got in Mitzrayim? Can you imagine? The Jews were being murdered. They were being slaughtered. Everything. Can you imagine how awful that must have been? They must have got the real rotten dreg of whatever was left over in all the Egyptian restaurants. They must have thrown to the Jews. And now they said, no, they remember the fish. You know that's the famous story of the, and this is really, it's not a true story. It is true stories, because it happens so often where a young couple get married and the young wife tries to please her husband, and she tries to find out what his tastes are. She checks with his mother and she learns what his tastes are, and she starts trying to prepare it, and each time he eats with half an appetite and he leaves and he doesn't want seconds and he doesn't say anything. He's very nice and polite, but she sees it's not working. One day, Erev Shabbos, she's in a rush. Shabbos is about to come in. Just before Shabbos comes in, she notices that she's left the thing on the stove too long, and it's burnt, and it's terrible, and she doesn't know what to do. And she tries to arrange for them to be invited out for Shabbos, and they can't. So she's stuck. What can you do? So she tries to dress it up as best she can, but she knows that it tastes burnt and horrible, and she's really very upset and very worried. And she serves it out to him, and he tastes it. Just like my mother made it. This is it. You've hit it right. It doesn't matter what it tastes like. If it's like the mother made it, it's good. And when you're homesick, that's what you want. That's the Jews here too. They're out in the desert. They've got nothing. They remember the fish of Egypt. And it's pathetic. But that's what they remember. So they ask for fish and meat. What does God give them? He gives them chicken. They didn't ask for chicken. They ask for fish and they ask for meat. So if you're acceding to their requests, give them fish, or give them meat, or give them both. God gives them chicken. Who asked for chicken? It's not. We're going to see what chicken is. Fish is parava. Meat is fleshic. Chicken is controversial. We regard it as meat. But from the Torah's point of view, it is not meat. Right? We regard it strictly as meat. In all senses of the word, it's treated exactly the same as meat. But that is a law of the rabbis. It's one of these things that's really in between. And the Torah regards it as just outside of the category of meat, but it's so close to the category of meat that the rabbis, for safety's sake, have placed it inside the category of meat. Right? But they didn't do that with fish. So there are three different kinds of food. There's meat, there's chicken, poultry, and there's fish. They asked for meat, they asked for fish. They wanted parava, they wanted fleshic. So God gives them something in the middle, which is neither parava nor fleshic. And that's to understand that. You might think that's got nothing to do with the piece of chumash in front of us, but you're wrong. Now, when a question is good, firstly, do you think that first question of ours, the contradiction between the verse in front of us and the verse in chapter 2, verse 19, is a good question? What do you think, Brian? Is that a good question?
Yeah, the
does it worry you, that question?
Yeah.
Do you think it's deserving of further investigation? Well, if it's a good question, it must appear somewhere in the Mefarshim, right? If it's a good question, then someone must have thought of it before us, because the Chumash has been studied in greater depth than we're doing over here for many, many years. But if it's a basic question, there's a difference between a good question and a basic question. If it's a basic question, then the Gemara must ask it, right? If it's basic to Jewish thought and Jewish philosophy. Now, I think that's taking it a bit too far. Would you agree, Brian? To say that it's basic to Jewish thought and philosophy, that would appear to be taking it a bit too far. Are the birds made from the water, or they made for the ground? I mean, it's a problem in the text. One has to understand it textually. But one wouldn't think that this is really an essential problem of Yiddishkeit. Would you agree with that analysis? Or do you think this is an essential problem of Yiddishkeit? In other words, where do we go looking? In the Gemara or in the Mefarshim? Where would you send us?
Into the Mefarshim.
I would have thought into the Mefarshim as well. The fact is, well, the Mefarshim might handle it as well, as in fact they do, but if it's dealt with in the Gemara, you know it's more than just a good question. You know it's then essential to Jewish knowledge, right? What's in the Mefarshim, you only need to know if it bothers you. There's a difference. The Mefarshim you look at when you have a difficulty in the Chumash. When you're learning, you have a problem, you look at the Mefarshim and you get the answer. But Gemara, you have to know whether you have the difficulty or you don't have the difficulty, because the sum total of Gemara is the sum total of Jewish knowledge, which it is incumbent upon every Jewish person to know. That's those 20 volumes there. Everybody has to know what's in those books. And therefore, if there's something which appears in the Gemara, if there's a question which the Gemara asks, then it's more than just a good question, and this is something which is basic. And so, in fact, the Gemara in Chulin does ask this question. The Gemara says the following. Katuv echad omer yishritzu amayim sheretz nefesh chaya ve'op yofer. One verse asks, the Gemara says, let the water bring forth, swarm forth living souls, and let the birds fly. Right? Alma mimayim ivru. So you see that these birds were created from water. V'chatuv echad omer v'yitzer Hashem Elokim min ha'adama at kol of hashamayim. And another verse says, God created from earth all the birds of the heaven. Right? That's our question. It's a question of the Gemara. So it's not just a good question, but it's a question basic to Yiddishkeit. So we can expect a mind-boggling, earth-shattering answer. If the Gemara poses the question, then one can expect something very, very, very special. Haketzad asks the Gemara, how can that be? Answers the Gemara. Min harakak nivra. They were created from mud. I felt very deflated when I saw that. You know? The question's a good question, and the question might be basic to Judaism, that I can still imagine. But that answer? You know, how can that? It says here they're created from sand, and it says here they're created from water. How can that be? Answer the Gemara, they were created from mud. What's it all about? But we'll see, this is something very, very deep. Now I'm going to introduce you to a delightful Perush, which is quite a modern one, not as old as the others that we've been doing. And these are really the notes. This, the man that we're talking about, the Klei Yochar, was a rabbi, and these are notes of his sermons. But there's some for the people in the back row there. Mm-hmm. Everybody have access to a Klei Yochar if they don't actually have it in front of them. You've got the Klei Yochar in here? Mm-hmm. You haven't? Maybe what is at the back? Let me see.
I'm sure.
Bottom paragraph on the left-hand column. The one which starts with the word Yishritzu. And this is all we're going to do tonight, just this one little paragraph, Yishritzu. Now follow with your fingers, because if you don't follow with your fingers, it's guaranteed that you'll lose the place. If you follow with your fingers, there's a chance that you'll keep up. So the Klei Yochar goes on the verse, Yishritzu hamayim sheretz nefesh chaya ve'op yofef. Let the water swarm forth, living. Further on, it says that the birds were created from the land. So here we see, Brian, that not only does the Gemara deal with it, but the Mefarshim deal with it as well. So it's both a good question and a basic question. Amru Razal, that abbreviation means Amru Rabotei Zal, our rabbis of blessed memory said, Derech Pesher, as an explanation, as a sort of a compromising explanation, Shenivru Min Harakat, that they were created from mud, from a mixture of sand and water. Nimtza, it emerges, sheha ofot, that birds, memutzaim min abahemot shenivru min haadama, are the mean of animals which are created from the earth, ובין הדגים שנבראו מן המים, and of fish which are created from the water. In other words, what Chazal is telling us is the nature of chickens, the nature of poultry, the nature of birds. It's a mixture. A bird is, in essence, we'll see in what way still in a moment, but in essence, a bird is not a completely new creature. A bird is a sort of a mean between meat and fish, between animal and fish. Right, so it makes good sense why the Chazal, why the rabbis have placed halachically, have placed chicken in the category of meat. One sees it's right on the borderline between chicken, between meat and fish, in terms of its nature, in terms of its essence. So what appeared to be a ridiculous piece of Gemara, talking about chickens being created from mud. Now if you told anybody outside, if they said, what did you learn in the Gemara this evening? And you said, we learned the chickens are made from mud. Nobody's going to believe you, nobody's going to take you seriously, but that's what the Gemara does say. But one has to understand that the Gemara is defining the essence of what a chicken is. It's a cross between a bird, between a wild animal and a fish. Now let's take the following sort of in brackets as an aside. He'll get back to the main theme in a moment. Horu b'zeh, the rabbis have taught with this, shegimul minim elu lo nivru'u ki im bavur ha'adam. They have taught with this that these three classes of animal have all been created by Avur HaAdam for man, liyot lo la'avadim, to be for him a slave. In other words, the Gemara's question, says the Klei Yakar, is much deeper than you thought. The Gemara's question is not what our question was, just that there's a contradiction. The Gemara says, what the Gemara's question really is, according to the Klei Yakar, is the following. You have animals which are created from the earth, fine. You have fish which are created from the water, fine. After all, animals walk on the earth and fish swim in the water, so we can understand that clearly. But the whole world is either dry land or water. And where do birds come from? So in other words, the Gemara is posing the question, could it be that birds are some mysterious class from outer space? I don't mean literally out of space, but that they're completely different. And while we know how to relate to the wild animals, and we know how to relate to the fish because we know what dry land is and we know what water is, maybe fish are some mysterious third type of being that we don't really know how to relate to at all. Some kind of angel, maybe. Some kind of... Sorry? Yeah. Birds, sorry. Maybe birds are some kind of mysterious third category that we don't really know how to relate to. Answer the Gemara, no. Don't think because it wasn't created from the land or it wasn't created from the water that it's something weird and outside the realm of our imagination. No, it was created from a mixture of both. Remez ledavar, this is beautiful. A hint to this is the word eved, a slave. Ayin, bet, dalet. Rashi tevot. Those are the first letters of each of the following words. Of, that's birds, behema, dagim. If you take the first letter of of, the first letter of behema, and the first letter of dagim, those are the three classes of creatures, and you put those first letters together, you have the word eved. Servant. And all the animals and all the birds and all the fish were created for the service of man, every one of them. You see how ridiculous it becomes now, the claim of the, what do they call themselves, not environmentalists, those people who don't like mice to be used for cancer research, they would rather people die from cancer. What are those people called? No, there's a whole thing. In America, it's a big problem. It's a very big and powerful movement. That's right, the vivisectionists, right. Anti-vivisectionists. I mean, you see the nonsense of it. Eved. That's what they are there for. That's the greatest fulfillment that an animal can reach, the highest level an animal can reach, is to serve a man. Provided the man is worthwhile. For a mouse to die, to save a great man, is the greatest thing that can happen to a mouse. But for a mouse to die to save a wicked man, is the worst thing that can ever happen to a mouse. So the responsibility is on us, on mankind, to make sure that what the mice are giving their lives for is something worthwhile. But not to stop the mice giving their lives for. Never, they've got nothing else to live for. What can a mouse live for? Imagine a mouse's concept, so to say, if one could talk in such terms, of having given his life to save humanity. There's nothing greater in terms of a mouse. Even human beings would die for that. One human being to give his life to save humanity, any one of us would do it. And certainly a mouse would do it. Or any other animal that they use for this purpose. But humanity must be worthwhile saving. Otherwise it's not fair on the mouse. That applies also to eating meat. Of course we're permitted to eat meat. In fact, it's a great mitzvah to eat meat, not just from the point of view of what the meat does to us, but also from the point of view of giving the animal an opportunity to live a worthwhile life. For an animal just to live, to be born, and to eat, and to sleep, and to eat, and to sleep, and to eat, and to sleep, and to die, that's not a life even for an animal. The culmination of an animal's life is to give his life for someone worthwhile. That he can participate and he can become part of you. That everything you achieve is not achieved only by you, it's also achieved by the food you ate, by the animals that you ate. That's part of what an animal is created for, but then you must be worthwhile. For an animal to become part of you and to be eaten and consumed by you and you're a nobody, that's not fair on the animal. He gave his life thinking he was giving his life for something wonderful and it turns out to be nothing. So the animals are avodim, the animals are servants of man, that's their purpose. Ki et hakol natan lo Hashem, because everything God gave to man, la avadim, as servants. The apex of the creation is man. That's where creation stopped. All this is building up to Adam, to the human being, to man. Everything is created for him. Thanks. V'yesh la'adam yad bayam uv'yabasha. And man has control over sea and over dry land, uv'shneyem yachad, and over the mixture of the two of them. Man controls the whole world and everything that comes therefrom. K'dei shelo yimtza ha'adam acharav mu'uma. So the man should know there is nothing to be found beyond that. Shelo nitan birshuto, which is not given to his, into his hands. Everything which is in this world has been given to us to use. There's nothing in the world which doesn't have a purpose in terms of human destiny. That's the first section of this Klayata. It's beautiful, isn't it? Now comes the important part. Uvederech remez, and again as a taking it a step further, matzinu kitot bnei adam, we find groups of human beings mityachsim legimul minim elu that can be paralleled to these three types. Let's have a look. Ki matzinu shaharashoim, one finds first of all the wicked people. Hanoitim achachelik haafruri biyoter, they are attracted by the most physical